Welcome to StubHub, the podcast where we break down what it really takes to succeed in today's app ecosystem. Today, I'm joined by Daniel Layfield from the Subscription Index about a moment every indie dev team hits. We've got a product people love. Now, how do we make money? We get into real-world strategies for early-stage monetization, how to avoid wasting time on features you don't really need, and what actually moves the needle when it comes to getting paid. Plus, you'll hear tactics that work, like Stripe's ML-powered retry logic, A/B testing annual plan pricing, and win-back strategies that cut churn by up to 15%. Let's get into it. First of all, I'd like to welcome you, Dan, to the show. Welcome to StubHub.
Thank you.
Let's jump into a little bit of discussion about kind of how you got to where you are today. I know you spent some time at Code Academy. Let's talk about that a little bit and hear about your experience.
Yeah, sure. So I guess I've been in kind of the subscription world / the subscription monetization world for like coming up on 10 years now. So the bulk of my experience was I was at Code Academy for 5 years, from about 20 people to 200 people. So I ran the growth team at Code Academy for most of that time. Growth at Code Academy really was about subscription monetization and conversion. So we had tons of traffic, we had tons of free users. When I got there, we were like not great at converting them or retaining them into paid users. So this was kind of circa 2017. So like all of the playbooks and blogs and podcasts like this one didn't exist yet. So we kind of stumbled around in the dark trying to learn the tactics, which we eventually figured out. So we were able to take it from about 10 million ARR when I got there to about 50 in 2021 or 2022, and then it sold in probably 2022 or 2023 for just over 500 million. So it ends up being like really successful, but I think, you know, a lot of people contributed to that success, but we definitely learned what makes monetization of big subscription products work. And we'll kind of dive into those.
Yeah, my experience with Code Academy is I was a code school teacher, and we often pointed our students at it because there were tons of free tools available there for people to learn stuff. So I totally understand what you're saying about having lots of free users, and then, you know, how do you turn that into a real business?
Yeah, exactly. All right. Like Code Academy is a great product, great company. And I think that's one of the things that enables monetization, is like the core product is really strong.
Yeah, if you don't have a good product and a good team, doesn't really matter what your strategy is, probably not going to work. Let's start from kind of the beginning. Let's say that we are a small dev team, maybe 2 to 5 people. We've built a product. We found proof that it's working, and we've got some product market fit. And now the question is, how do we turn that into a business that makes money? Kind of maybe to start, if let's imagine ourselves in that position, when should we focus on monetization? Or, you know,
from the
beginning or at some point in the middle?
So I think it depends a little bit on the product you have. I think the best way of determining if anybody wants your product is they will pay something. So when I say focus on monetization, it doesn't mean don't charge at all or give everything away for free. But if you think about what monetization's doing, it's like the product development you're undertaking creates value. Monetization is like what percent of that value you capture in the form of money to like keep the business going and et cetera, et cetera. So I think I wouldn't focus on monetization until you're confident you have like a level of product market fit. So product market fit is obviously like a gradient from kind of like weak but functioning product market fit to really, really, really strong. You know, people are clamoring for your product constantly. I think you want to be confident you have product market fit before you focus on any monetization.
Like you said, focusing, maybe not super focusing on it, doesn't mean not doing it at all, right? Not running
experiments. Yeah, it doesn't mean don't do it.
Not trying things. It just means maybe don't spend all your energy on trying to convert.
Yeah, and I think when you think about product market fit, I'd say there's like two broadly acceptable ways of measuring it. Probably the most well-known one is what I'd call like the Sean Ellis survey from Hack and Grow, which is, you know, you survey your user base, you ask them if they lost access to the product, would you be like very disappointed, somewhat disappointed, or not disappointed at all? And you want 40% of people to be very disappointed. So I think like we tried this at Code Academy, we scored over 40. I'm not familiar enough with this technique to say like is 39, like not even close. And is 40 on the nose acceptable move on? But I would say you want to be around 40% somewhere. I'd say a note on surveying is we did this at Code Academy. We got some good advice from a research firm that you probably want over 200 filled out surveys for surveys to be statistically significant. So if you kind of back that up from the amount of people you probably have to email, you're probably looking at like a 4,000 or 5,000 emails to get a 5% click-through rate to get 200 surveys filled out or something like that. Again, I think the requirements are a little blurry here. Where like if you get 150, I don't think you should throw the data out. And getting 400 instead of 200, I don't know if it's meaningfully different. different. But you want to be like reasonably confident you have product market fit.
So really the first step is having 4,000 people you can email about it, right? So that's, you got to get that far. And then once you do, like you said, right, you can sort of survey them and see if, I like the wording of that where it's like, how upset would you be if this went away tomorrow?
Yeah, exactly.
That's very different from just saying, do you like this, right? Like you might get a lot of people who said they like it, but if really for, like you said, for product market fit, you really want, this is indispensable to me. I need this in my job, in my life, whatever sort of thing is trying to fill for that person. Need is much more important than maybe want or like, right?
Yeah, my favorite definition of product market fit comes from Y Combinator, which is like people want your product so badly, it's destroying your company. It's like you have so much inbound that it like wrecks all of your internal processes. That's extreme product market fit. And that's obviously what we all want. But you definitely need a level of this.
Right. It's like the classic sort of, it's a good problem to have, right? If your company's being somewhat destroyed by the popularity of it, it's a problem, but it's also kind of a good problem to have.
I'd say more, I don't know, maybe measurable way of determining if your product market fit is you could draw retention curves. So if you put all of your monthly cohorts into the same graph and you start them all at month zero and you chart the percentage of the cohort that's still left, you should see that curve flatten at some point. So if your curve goes all the way down to zero, it means in time you lose 100% of your users. It's hard to stack up a user base at that point. There's a little bit of nuance there. Like you might have user life cycles of 8 months and you started a company 3 months ago and it's like you just don't know yet. But you should see that curve flatten at some point. That's somewhat easier. You can do that with smaller amounts of users. Like you'd run that on 100 users and just kind of see what happens. Obviously, the more data you have, the better. I'd say the bigger the company gets, retention curves are the better way of determining product market fit.
And so maybe the kind of the, out of all of this, the clarity that people should have is that product market fit is not, there's not like a number or a date or something like that that is going to say, well, if we hit this, we've definitely gotten product market fit. It's not binary. It's more of, like you said, the curve starts to flatten. You get maybe 40% or a little bit less, a little bit more, depending on how old your company is. There's lots of factors that go into this to help you kind of make that decision. And it's more a collection of data that proves to you that you're there rather than like a single piece of data.
Yeah, I'd say there's other measures too. Like I was talking to a founder the other day that I asked the same question to because he wanted to focus on monetization. And he just kind of sent me a Stripe dashboard. It's like, I make 4 million ARR. It's like, all right, well, you're probably like, you have some level of product market fit that like, we should drill into it and determine kind of where it is. But if revenue is increasing dramatically every month, you're probably also there, even if it's a less scientific way of measuring.
Yeah, I mean, 4 million ARR, that's something that probably some people would be like, well, that'd be my end game. Not even the beginning, but that's great. As far as charging, because it's not as important to maybe focus on monetization at this point, like you said, you don't not do it at all, but certainly not something you need to sort of endlessly worry about. With that in mind, do you have thoughts on like, does the pricing super matter at this point? Or are you just kind of throwing out experiments? If someone was going to do a bit of monetization to start testing, what advice do you have for, and I don't need individual price, numbers, but just
question.
Kind of what kind of advice would you give on how much to worry about monetization since we're not worrying about it that much?
Yeah, I would say this. Signal you're looking for here is that like people you're building this for will pay you something that's meaningful to them. So that depends a lot on the product category, who they are, where they are in the world, etc. I think we had this a lot at Code Academy that people who love the product but are willing to pay you zero for it, in a sense, like aren't the end users you're pursuing, even if we're happy that they come to the product a lot. But really like the surest fire way you can tell is you're solving a meaningful problem for them is they pay you something for it. Like if almost like push that to the extremes, if you're building enterprise analytics tools and you're charging $1 a month, you can have no product market fit and it's so cheap compared to the alternatives that you'll see people come in, but it almost like dilutes the signal you're looking for. So I'd say be somewhere around average. I know there's a lot of advice around establishing brands that you want to be premium, but it's really like the product value that establishes the premium brand. So if your product is an order of magnitude better than everybody else, you can justify that price, but it's really the value you create in the product which causes the price.
So yeah, I think maybe the advice there is to, don't charge $1 million, right? Don't vastly outprice everybody else because you haven't proven anything yet about what your value you're providing. But I like the insight of also don't go so cheap that the point of what you're trying to do is not sort of set a hard and fast rule on your pricing. You are experimenting, but if you're gathering quote unquote bad data, the experimentation isn't valuable to you. So like you said, a $1 a month enterprise analytics tool, it's probably going to be pretty popular because it's so cheap compared to everybody else. But does that mean anything, right? It may or may not mean anything to you. And so the middle ground is probably the, the right way, where you're not so expensive that people are going to just not consider you because you're unproven, but you're also not so cheap that it's like a fire sale, you know, bargain basement. Why would we not pay for this? Really, that's both ends are unhelpful.
Your price will likely go up with time as your product gets better. Combination of your product getting better and you understanding the niche and ICPs you want to play in better typically means your price will go up at some point. And like price testing is a thing we can talk about. But I say in the beginning, like what you're looking for is enough throughput through the system and the signal of like who this is meaningful for enough to pay for.
So let's talk a little bit beyond like just monetization and that early sort of testing. We've got some product market fit. We're testing different sort of monetization strategies to, like you said, get useful signal from the noise. But beyond those things, what else do you need in order to build like a sustainable engine that will continue to let the business grow?
Yeah, it's a great question. I'd say you basically need three things. One is like an acquisition system or channel that like brings people to you. You then have like the core product that's there to solve the problem. Then you have the monetization engine that like captures some of the value that feeds the other two, the building of the product and the acquiring of people and the hiring of teams and et cetera. So it's like you need all three of those, and monetization is like one piece of the puzzle, but it kind of inherently overlaps into the other ones. Like you need to pay for acquisition somehow. So how you pay for acquisition depends on your monetization model and vice versa. And your product needs to create enough value that you can justify charging for enough money. So the product has to be good.
Yeah. I mean, the tripod there is pretty important. Right? You got to have all those legs in order for it to work. But then I guess maybe the challenge is they all kind of rely on each other in a sense. So if you're starting from scratch, which leg do you work on first and how do they all sort of, you know, interconnect? It's complex, but.
Yeah, exactly. I'd say almost everybody starts with the product, but I think the products that you see take off have what's called like channel product fit, where like you can distribute the product easily through channels that make sense. That's a concept from a company called Reforge, which is great at product and growth training. Kind of like if you look at the companies that do well distributing through Facebook ads, it's ones where like you can justify the cost of the ad and you can recycle the cash back through the acquisition system really, really quickly to fuel more ads. So I'm making this number up, but my guess is one of the larger spenders of Facebook ads or e-commerce brands, because different than subscription companies, like they capture most of the LTV upfront, which you can immediately redeploy the cash back into acquisition. You know, most subscription companies that I've seen, I haven't seen a ton where Facebook ads are like the leading driver of their acquisition, because you capture the LTV spread out across the life cycle, which means the payback cycle on the cash is really, really slow. Same with like sales channel distribution. Like if you are relying on a sales team to do outbound for you, you need to be able to afford a sales team. So you need to be solving a problem that's expensive enough that you can justify hiring those people, paying for them, and then getting the cash back.
Yeah, at Adaptia, we often give general advice to subscription apps that before you even bother with like paid UA, right, that you should probably have like an LTV to CAC ratio of at least 3-1 so that you have enough cash to fuel the acquisition, because it's going to cost you money. And if you're not making enough and holding enough, then you're essentially burning money, right? Maybe you're spending money to acquire customers, but if they don't stick around long enough or they don't convert or whatever, which a bunch of them are not going to do that, they're going to leave. You have to have that engine has to be sort of self-sustaining enough, right, to make the paid UA worth it. Otherwise, you're literally throwing money away. Like you're capturing customers, yeah, exactly. They're sticking around for a minute and they're leaving, and you're like, well, I got nothing out of that.
Yeah, 100%. So, yeah, I think it's almost the same with user-to-user referrals. Like user-to-user referrals work when your user knows a ton of other potential users. If your user only knows a few other users, the likely conversion of that is not super high. So like Uber and Dropbox rode really good referral programs because everyone, if you live in a city, almost everyone you know takes cabs, or anyone on the internet needs a level of file storage. Like we struggled with referrals at Code Academy because even amongst our users, they only knew a handful were looking to program, not literally everybody they know. So it ended up being like not a great channel for us. We could have optimized it, but for us, it was always word of mouth SEO, free product distribution.
Yeah. Well, that's maybe why it's important to think carefully about this stuff too, because if you were to, I think maybe if you think about it at first glance, you know, learning to code is extremely popular and you might assume, oh, well, Code Academy must do really well with referrals because everybody wants to learn how to code so they can hand out links and stuff. But if you really think about it, yes, that's true, very broadly speaking. But if you then go kind of, you know, user to user, like you said, maybe they know a couple of people who might be interested, but they're not going to know 20, 30, 40 people. Everybody they know is not going to be interested in that. And you want to think carefully about who your audience is before you apply a strategy like that.
What's helpful is probably like doing the math on some of these channels with like reasonable assumptions. So Code Academy, when you consider it like millions of users, referrals could make sense, but we you forget is those millions of free users. And we basically like can't afford to compensate free users to refer free users. And like likely they just do it anyway because they like the product. When you get into the paid users, you're in like the tens or hundreds of thousands. And like at what percentage of those are online in any given month, you remove a decent amount of them. Then like what percent ever find the referral system? 5%. Then you send emails. What percent open those emails? 10%. You're like in a really, really small pool pretty quickly. And it's like that the investment in growing that is not as good as focused on the other channels that are working.
So how do you decide what, like when to stop, I guess is my question. Like, so you've started a word of mouth campaign or an SEO based campaign or a paid campaign or something like that. There are certainly numbers that you can use as evidence to kind of give yourself a sense of how this is doing. What if it's not clearly a total failure and also not clearly a super, you know, broad success? A small team has, I think, to be very, they need to be very careful about how they spend their time. Yep. That's their most precious asset.
Yeah, it's a great question. I'd say I caveat this with like most of my background is monetization and conversion, not acquisition. The things that I've seen work in companies is most companies I see in the growth stage, you really have one channel that's contributing a massively outsized proportion. It's less likely they have a ton of small channels, like netting up to be one. So once you get a sense that one is 2x larger than the others, I would keep pouring into that to get it to work.
So maybe less about calling things quits and saying, oh, we're just going to double down because this thing over here is the clear winner. And then the other things are just going to kind of atrophy almost naturally because you're just going to spend all your time on one channel that's working really well.
Yeah. And I think effort, you know, can be categorized different ways. If you're creating TikTok content that kind of just can't run in the background, you stop production. But if you're like running SEM ads, like that kind of can happen in the background, the question is how much budget you want to put into it.
Right. Yes. Yeah, so maybe you dial down the budget and you say, we're going to pour that money into this other thing, but we'll let that run just in case, right? But we're going to spend our time and our energy and our money on the thing that's definitely working. So let's say that we've found a channel that works, right? And we're at a point where we're starting to regularly acquire users. And now we need to figure out how to realize some value from the value that we're creating for customers and the value that the business is creating by adding users to its user base. We then want to now pull some value out in the form of, you know, monetization. What are some things that we want to think about, you know, maybe on the pro and the con side there?
Yeah, I'd say maybe it's easiest to start with the things not to do, because those can be clear and like everybody learns these mistakes at some point. I'd say the main mistake we made at phases of Code Academy, and I see a lot of companies make, is you make things too complicated too early. So like the complexity tax is real. Things get built once and then you have to consider it into your feature development or into your marketing development every single time after that. So I think the almost like North Star you should take is like what works and keeps your future product velocity high. So I think a really common pitfall that everybody makes is you see companies bigger than you and you just kind of like one-to-one copy everything they're doing. Like they have bigger resources. It's also like a thing that really was hammered home for me at Code Academy that we launched stuff that failed and then you'd see our competitors copy it, not knowing that like we stopped paying attention to this because it doesn't work and we just were like not prioritizing the engineering effort to take it down or fix it or something like that. And it's like, in a sense, these like little paper cuts of complexity really add up to slow things down. And the bigger the company gets, the more expensive it is to unwind these things. So it's like, this is an easy thing to say and a hard thing to do in reality. But I think things that add a lot of complexity, especially within monetization systems, is like adding multiple service tiers to a product too early. So this is especially for B2C products, where consumer products that do well tend to stay simple for a long time and like nail one or two use cases. So you think of like Netflix didn't add tiered pricing for probably 10 or 15 years after it went digital. Like Headway and Calm are still kind of single tiered. I was at Code Academy past its 10-year anniversary. We still just had really one tier of products. So I think for consumer products, you want to keep that simple. Same with like geo-based pricing. So like, do you want to localize prices in different countries? It's a push and a pull. It's a harder one to answer, but I would avoid that for as long as you can. Because the second you add different prices, you need multiple versions of all your ads. You need multiple versions of all your email campaigns. You need to like check this localization doesn't break down somewhere. You need to protect against VPNs. It's almost like I would exhaust the core opportunities first of like onboarding, activation, core user experience, basic win back strategies, payment processing if you're not on an app, and just like really avoid the complexity if you can. I think similar on that note is like staying laser focused on what works. Like one of the hardest things to avoid in startup is like cool, interesting ideas that are like similar to what you're doing, but aren't exactly what you're doing. I think when you sit
as a founding team, that's what got you into it in the first place, probably, right? Like you found an interesting problem that you wanted to solve that people weren't doing well. And you're like, let's do that. So the temptation to do that again is going to be very high.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And I think it's like, it's right around the time that most of the low hanging fruit on your original thing is gone, and getting incremental gains is starting to get really hard. And it's like, oh, we should build a second product here. We should build a B2B version. We should layer in some other level of complexity. And it's like most of the great teams stay really focused on making the core thing the core thing.
I love that insight that you had about like companies looking at other larger companies and seeing what they're doing, having real no insight or context into why they're doing it, or if, like you said, if they've stopped doing it and maybe they're just not, it's not gone, they're just not paying attention to it anymore. They realize that it failed. That can be a real distraction. So what would your advice be on, should we care at all about what competitors are doing, or should we purely ignore their activity?
I'd say whether you should build features should be up to you. Like once you've decided that you need a thing, how you build it, you should look at what other companies are doing that are working. So if you take like any big example of like checkout pages, cancellation flows, like within the feature itself, trying to keep complexity low, like take the best practices. You don't have to take them one-to-one, but like, especially from like a design and design systems perspective, just like take what you see the industry doing that's effective and don't reinvent the wheel, especially for stuff that's been around for a long time and like feature sets that have existed for a long time. So think comments, notes, lifecycle email, sharing, settings, checkout. Like that stuff should all be relatively boilerplate. Like whether you should do it is up to you.
But decide that you, right, decide whether you want to make a wheel at all, right, yourself, and then 100%. See, well, how is everybody else doing it? Right, right. So let's say that we're better than most, and we are trying to stay laser focused on the few core things that we're really good at. How would we judge how well we're doing at being laser focused, right? What are the metrics that we would want to look at to judge that?
I think measurement's kind of like a rabbit hole you could go down. But I think once you're post product market fit and you're not 100% operating on instinct. So kind of pre-product market fit, you don't have anything to measure. So you kind of have to go off of your historical research, your gut feeling and your velocity, and you get to something that works. Something that works, like I was saying, is like a basic level of retention, some level of monetization, people staying around. I think you want to set up within a subscription business, I'd say the basic monetization metrics and the basic user lifecycle metrics. So on the monetization side, it's like how many people are top of the funnel. So hit the account, see your landing pages, sign up for free accounts, download, etc. How many people like start trial experiences, and especially if it's a subscription, how well do you retain through the months? So on a month over month basis, like how both within the month, how well are you retaining? And then if you stack them up to cohorts, like on average, where do you start to lose and see people drop off? So you'll know your churn rates, you'll know your rough LTV numbers, you'll know roughly your MRR and ARR and those type of things. On the lifecycle side, I'd say the basic lifecycle metrics are kind of like sign up, set up, kind of like early aha or a win, like early lifecycle and then retain. So like I would map the users, those are more custom to you, of like sign up is typically like, do you first see it and download the thing? Set up is could be like account creation or filling in your address, or like what do you do to receive value from the product? Aha is a subjective one, but it's like, what's your earliest win? So if you're a fitness app, it could be like right after your first class is completed, or it's right after your first class is completed and you share the progress to a friend or something like that. Like when does a user start to feel it? And then like, what do those early lifecycle stages look like? I think if you don't have those, it's tough to pull apart your churn numbers and understand, like we see a lot of people drop at month three. Is it because they never activated, or is it because they just got all the value from the product and their lifecycle is just kind of over, or did they hit like a big problem?
Are there metrics that you've seen that are, they look shiny and they look interesting and they look valuable, but it turns out they're really not that interesting? Like the ones you covered, I think make total sense. Are there ones that might be a mirage, right? Like it's like, oh, we should track that because that will be really important. It turns out that it's actually not important at all.
Yeah, I'd say it's things like misdefined monthly active users or weekly active users. So I think you should define active by whatever the core of the product does. So like not they just hit your website. So in the Code Academy example, it should be like they submitted code or they tried to submit code or something like that. I think it's really easy to get lost in those top level vanity or like total ever registered users. Like what you care about is they find it, stay around and keep paying you. And you should measure as close to that as possible. Not saying don't use those to raise money or, you know, feel fancy on Twitter or whatever. But like the business is going to be driven by how many people stay around.
Well, and a good sort of general axiom is, right, don't lie to yourself, right? Like if 100%. And when I say lie, sometimes it's marketing, sometimes it's lying, depends, right? But at least don't be honest internally, right? Like, yeah, there's 16 ways we can measure an active user, but the one that we care about about for the growth of our business is, like you said, they've done something meaningful in the on the platform, not just they logged in or they read the welcome message or, you know, whatever other thing you might be using to track that kind of stuff.
Yeah, and I think as you evolve as a product development team, you start like picking metrics and targeting them, and you want to typically target the furthest upstream actionable thing. So almost everybody works on churn initially by like optimizing your churn surveys and flows. Like, and that is good and that can make an impact. But the main way you're going to lower churn is better activating people right at the beginning of the product. And it's like by the time they're in there, you can maybe save 10 to 15% of them, which still is great to lower churn numbers. But like you'll drop churn dramatically much, much further up in the life cycle.
Yeah, I mean, we found with subscription apps that upwards of like 80% of people in, you know, consumer subscription mobile application are going to decide pretty much the first use, the first couple of uses, certainly like the first day, whether or not this is worth using, whether or not it's worth paying for. And so if you don't get that right, you are definitely leaving that on, you know, that money and that user on the table. They're not going to convert. They're probably not even going to come back. And they're probably not going to reopen the application, right? So the beginning of that funnel there is critically important.
Yeah, like think of the amount of tech products you've probably touched in your life, like 10,000, like maybe more. Like how many do you remember? Like 100? How many do you use? Like 15? Like, and part of that is like, you may not have been the right user for that product. And that, you know, that's a different acquisition consideration. But also it's like, you really have to like hook people well early to get them to stay around and remember you.
Yeah, there's been some where I go to try it and I'm like, oh, this is not for me, but it's not their fault. Whereas there's been also lots of them I'm like, oh, this could be for me, but it's so terrible that I don't want to use it. That's probably the more common case for dropping something, is that it's not very good. And that's something that could be fixed. So I think we've got some good metrics. What about sort of the metric of productivity, right? Certainly something that dev teams and companies are probably going to pride themselves, I think maybe dev teams in particular, are going to pride themselves on, which is shipping incremental updates, you know, acting fast, maybe, you know, down to weekly updates, nightly builds, that kind of thing. That is a very common consideration on a dev team. And if, let's say, the company we're talking about is predominantly just a dev, you know, if those are the people that are actually kind of the principals within the business, I could see how that could end up becoming dominant, that kind of thinking could become dominant across the whole business as far as productivity and progress, instead of just where it really belongs, which is a part of it, right? It's a part of that, but not the entirety. So how do we hold that at bay?
I was going to say, there's kind of like two answers here, which are related. Like if you can't ship frequently, it's really unlikely that you're productive. So you need like a baseline level of velocity. And velocity is like always king, especially in early stage startups. But I think the layer of velocity that everyone thinks about is kind of accuracy. Of like, you can ship a bunch of stuff, but did it do the thing that you thought it was going to do? And to do that, you have to measure. So it's like, that's why even if you don't want to go super deep down the measurement rabbit hole, I would start tracking something, even just like a basic outline of metrics, and reviewing with at the team every month, I would say, or maybe even every week, depending on how quickly you ship. I'd say an even more advanced version of that is like, you're using that metrics hierarchy to try to explain the impact of the thing you just did. So like, look at a timeline of the stuff you shipped in the product, look at what it should have impacted. Then like every week, look at your metrics and see if it did. One of the, I think the secrets of successful startups is because they look at their metrics, they undo their mistakes faster than everybody else. So in my lifetime as a PM, I've shipped tons of stuff that I thought was going to be great and it was terrible. And it like really broke some metric, either intentionally or unintentionally. Like, companies get good because they find and fix that stuff fast. Nothing's more painful than thinking like a project that you sweat to get out the door 6 months ago not only wasn't positive, but actually has been hurting you for 6 months and no one looked.
Yeah, I mean, it could be very easy to focus on the timeline. Like, we shipped this on time, right? That's our metric. Sure, that's a metric. I don't think that's the right one, but that's because ultimately your customers don't care about that, right? Is it any good? That's what matters. So it totally makes sense that it would be very easy to get that wrong. And I like the point too about, you're going to make mistakes. Don't think that you won't. You're going to make mistakes, right? This mechanism of checking and evaluating the impact is really what is going to give you that early alarm system on, oh, turns out we thought we'd solved this problem. We actually did not, with a week or two's worth of reflection. And now we need to fix it, but we will. We know what it is. We can fix it. We'll fix it in the next release rather than letting it fester.
Yeah, like if you're in the startup game and you haven't been in a fire drill yet, like it's just a matter of time of like something that was always going well all of a sudden starts going terribly and we don't know why. And like unless you have good measurement set up, it's really tough to figure it out.
So how do you keep an understanding of your users and what they will find, maybe not important, but what they will be annoyed by? Like, is there a way to keep track or to just understand how little a problem you can have where maybe it's like, okay, this isn't worth working on right this minute because it's so little a problem that maybe our users won't even notice, versus I think there's maybe like a space between huge problem that's very obvious to everyone, tiny problem that no one probably is going to notice, and problem that's big enough that our users will probably care some, but not care enough to complain or to cancel, but it still kind of like nags at them, and those can certainly stack up, right? And then eventually you end up in a place where maybe people are churning and you're like, what's wrong? Our product is great. People like it. There's not one big thing that's wrong here, but it's kind of a collection. It turns out it's actually a collection of small things. Is there any way to sort of combat that?
I think one of the almost like hidden layers of growth is keeping quality high. So I think when you're an early stage startup, you ship a bunch of stuff, you build a bunch of MPs, you kind of like don't know the right evolution path for your features. So you build a bunch of stuff and hopefully you measure. I think a skill that really good teams have is going back and kind of like curating what already exists and patching up stuff that's really hacky. I think one of the things that you see in really great teams is like they go through the product weekly. They go all the way back, they create new accounts, they go all the way back to the start and they re-look and onboard. Eventually you get like a little blind to the way the product looks because like you've looked at it, you built it for 2 years. But I think having other people do that for you is really, really impactful, especially people with like design backgrounds, especially people who are the same ICP as your user. I think one of the hardest things to detect in either metrics surveying or user interviewing is people who leave really early in the experience. Because even if you survey them a week later, they probably don't even remember your product exists. And if they're so uninterested, they won't take even an early step. They're not going to get on a user interview with you. So it's really getting like fresh eyes on those products helps a lot.
Yeah, the problem of being too close to it and not seeing, you know, the forest for the trees or seeing the problems that exist is very common. And I think devs are maybe, as much as anyone, we're just as guilty, right, of that kind of thing. Like, no, it's fine. And then someone points out something that is definitely wrong. And it is an interesting sort of experience to go from not recognizing it as a problem at all to someone points it out to you. And then you're like, oh yeah, that really is a problem. We do need to fix that. So having that fresh set of eyes is so critical.
Yeah, and I think one of the hardest things to avoid, especially when you've been in a product for a long time, and I've done this myself, is like you understand stuff is like clunky or broken and you just know the history. And when someone explains, you're like, oh, that's because 2 years ago we did this and we just kind of patched it and like we didn't really fix it. But like the users don't care. Like users, one of the biggest lessons in being a product manager is like you view your product as like a collection of features and spaces. And to the users is just one thing. All the way from your initial email, website, marketing, which they may not have seen in 3 months, through the whole product is just one like blob of an experience. And they don't see it as like, oh, part A of the product is really strong, but part B is weak. So like, oh, part A is great. I should love part A. They just don't like the whole thing.
They're not going to read through the long tapestry of the history of your app and understand, oh, well, these things exist because of these reasons. And they're not going to see that. They're not going to care about it. Like you said, it's just going to be one monolith to them. And if it's either good or it's not good, right?
I don't know how many enterprise products I use as a part of my day job, but it's like, I don't even know what pricing plan I'm in. Like to me, this is just like a thing I go do to solve a problem in this app to do my job. And like those teams are probably put tons of thought and effort into the naming and the pricing, and that stuff is important. But really, it's just like net user experience is what's valuable.
Yeah, and an enterprise app, it could be that you even, you're like, oh, this enterprise app it doesn't work for me because of X. And X is actually some small subcomponent that has a dedicated team of people working on it, but is, you know, one of 100 different teams. And it's, and you know, to the company, it's this complex sort of, you know, web of things that make up the product. But to you, you might, you know, decide, oh, well, I don't like the entire thing because this one thing that I have to interact with, comparatively speaking, pretty small, just doesn't work very well. And again, it's I think that's a hard mindset to the sort of explaining away of the complexity is a hard mindset to get out of
It's extremely hard.
Right.
And I'd say it's like if you were to focus anywhere, it's wherever the core value prop is. So like, you know, if I'm using, let's say, an analytics vendor and I don't trust that they're calculating the analytics correctly, it doesn't matter. The reports, the customizability, the sharing functionality, like any of the other bells and whistles they built into the product, because like its main job isn't strong enough.
Yeah. And if you don't have that baseline trust, then it doesn't matter what else it does. You're going to turn out and pick something else because maybe it isn't as fancy or has as many bells and whistles, but it's as from what you can tell, it's accurate. Right, that's the difference. We've talked a lot about like things that do work and things that don't work. Let's kind of talk about like best practices around all this stuff that does seem to work consistently. And let's start with churn. We've talked about churn quite a bit here, particularly maybe involuntary churn. Maybe talk a little bit about kind of what that means and how we might be able to fight it.
One of the best or maybe the highest ROI places to focus in companies that are monetizing for the first time. I'd say fits under the broad bucket of like, once people have decided to pay you money, try not to screw that up. So like collect the money, don't lose them for credit card reasons, etc. Depending on what like platform, if you're in an app store, your hands are more tight here. But if you're on a platform like Stripe and you're collecting payments off of the app stores, you have more options. I'd say the thing that I work with consultants or companies on pretty much on day one is setting up like automated retry processes correctly. So if you're in Stripe has what I'd call like a dumb retry process and a smart retry process. Stripe out of the box comes with kind of just default. If a card fails, try every 3, 5, 7, 9 days. I think across any of the payment processing tools, I've seen their machine learning driven platforms work better. So if you're on a platform like Recurly or Chargebee, they have these tools. There's specialty ones called like Butter. Churnkey has a tool like this. I'm sure, I don't know if you guys do payment retry process, but if you do, you probably have a tool set up like this. So just making sure you're using some layer of smart logic. So what that logic does is it's trying to use an ML algorithm to guess the best time for people to retry cards. So like if you only set up it to retry every like 2, 3, 4, or 5 days, it's probably 15 days between people getting paid. So like you might fail a charge because something, they don't have the money in their account, but they're not going to have money in their account again for 15 days. Like, or they're in a country that's really hard to process and all the data that gets piped through these ML models to calculate risk, there's false positives in them. And maybe you want to spread them out a certain amount before you charge them. Typically in most of these tools, it's like a 1 or 2 minute settings change. You might jump up into a higher tier, but to me, the ROI has always been worth it. And it's really, really easy.
And so your baseline of that is that even if it costs more, the ROI, right? The amount of money you're going to gain by gathering those additional charges that you otherwise would not get because they didn't go through the first or second or third time, is it outweighs the cost, right? Basically you're doing better. And and especially it sounds like if it's a couple of minutes, right? If it's a click a couple of buttons, I wonder why these tools don't just enable this by default.
You know, some do. We used Recurly Code Academy back in the day. I think we had to enable this. They might have changed this. I think I've heard from Stripe, they were debating changing it, but they also use it to justify a higher price tier, which I do think is, you know, worth it. And you should turn on. I'd say depends on the tool. There's a lot of ways of doing this too, that like emailing people once their cards fail. And so Stripe does this out of the box. I don't think the email templates are customizable, unfortunately. A lot of the other providers do allow you to customize the emails. Just putting like 4 hours worth of love into these emails to just like say who you are, restate why they're getting this email, make the link easy. If possible, don't make them sign back in to an account they may have forgotten the password to fix this. Or, you know, there's more advanced tactics, like if they've been on the product for more than X months, like offer them a discount to fix this. There's a lot of ways of slicing this, but just doing something basic here, I think helps. I think in terms of order of magnitude, like for recurring payment fails, I'd say maybe a good benchmark that I see for web-based products is maybe they're failing like 7 to 10% of payments every month. And if they're good at recovery, they're recovering half of those. But it still means like net, you churn 3 to 5% of every month's subscriptions due to involuntary churn. And it's just super painful over time.
And so then the caveat to this too, is that if we're talking about like a mobile application on the App Store or Google Play, though, because those platform vendors are the ones that are actually managing the selling process, this is not something that you need to really worry about. Those platforms are going to handle this however they handle it. And it's essentially opaque to you. And it just is what it is, right? Whatever they do or don't do.
Yeah, I think you might be able to still detect things and handle the emailing yourself. Like, you know, if someone's already failed a transaction and they get 2 emails instead of one, because Apple probably or Google probably send them, you can send them two. You know, if you can set that up in a few days and claw back like 2 or 3% of churn, like, great. To me, that's a good trade. But I think everyone complains about the App Store fees. We actually do get a lot out of the box. Like, they handle payment processing for you. They handle churn for you. They handle currency localization for you. You get a checkout page that works really well. Like, you know, there is value there.
And a platform that, generally speaking, people trust, right? They're willing to put their credit card into the system and use it regularly. So let's talk a little about a user that has canceled, they have churned. Is there any hope of getting them back? What kind of things can you do to try and, you know, see if you win them back?
Whether you can get them back first probably is determined by the use case your product's in. So like, is the problem you're solving coming back around? And in which case, like, yeah, you have a shot at winning them back. So like dating apps, people go into relationships and they come out of relationships. Like, I think they probably have pretty good success winning people back. But if you're like trying a hobby for the first time and I want to learn piano and then I hate it, nothing that app does can ever win me back. I think it really depends first on, like, are you in a use case that comes back around? I'd say maybe one step earlier in the funnel for that. Again, this is a little different for mobile versus web, but you can, in my experience, get 5, 10, 15% of a churn reduction by setting up best practices in your cancellation flow. So, like, you probably have one shot to win them. You're not going to save even the vast majority of them. But setting up a survey where you ask people the reason they're leaving, this data is notoriously bad and ineffective, but it's probably still the best practice. And then depending on their answer, you probably get one shot at winning them back. So the example that I always cite is, like, the New York Times has a really good cancellation flow. So if you want, like, go sign up for the Times, then cancel. No matter what you click on, they'll take one shot of saving you. So if, like, I'm too busy to read it, they'll let you put it on pause. If it's too expensive, they'll give you, like, a 2-month discount, and then they bump you back up to the original price. If you had technical issues, they'll connect you with a support person. So it's like, again, it's not going to solve most of the core problems, but there's a percentage of those users that you could win back.
Why is it the surveys and things like that are, I've heard, best practices and are very popular? Why is it that it's so notoriously unreliable? Is it because the user's kind of in basically just a negative headspace probably around your product, and they're just more likely to maybe rant at you than anything else? Is it, it's just sort of, they're not in a headspace to give you, I guess, what I would call, like, objective feedback of what they don't like. It's more just like, I don't like this because of X, that may or may not have anything to do with what you're actually doing.
Yeah, I think just the user's intent at that level is pretty low. So as far as I've seen most cancellation data, like, price is the number one objection. But price really means, like, you don't see value. So the question is, like, why don't you see value? I think I found some anecdotally useful things in survey data, but it typically is around, like, technical issues. Like, if someone's kind enough to say why they're leaving and you have a technical bug somewhere, it's a type of data that's, like, good to monitor once a month. But I don't think I've ever seen life-changing results there. But you also shouldn't be blind to it.
Yeah, so pay attention, but don't obsess about it, right? It's not worth, yeah, over-indexing.
But I'd say, like, the universe of tactics within those surveys are helpful. And they're one of, like, the small things that can add up to boosting your monetization. So I'd say the big ones are basically, like, put an account on pause, offer a small temporary discount. If you have multiple tiers, like, switch them down to a smaller tier, connect people with support if they're having big issues. Like I was saying, those tactics are going to be more effective if you're actually solving a real problem with them versus, like, you're just kind of spraying them to see if anybody does one. So I went to Cancel Clear, the travel membership in the US, and, like, I wasn't traveling for the next couple of months. They offered to put it on pause for 3 months, and that was just around long enough where it's, like, over Thanksgiving. I'm like, oh, well, we are probably traveling then, and I have 2 young kids, and et cetera, et cetera. So yeah, they got me for another year on Clear, where I probably would have just left.
So it's kind of like the same advice around maybe, like, you know, relationships and interpersonal stuff, right? People can smell desperation. And so in this situation, don't be desperate, right? Like they're leaving, they're maybe mad at you. Take a shot, see if there's some way that maybe you could partially, maybe at least partially mend the situation or the relationship a little bit. But you take that shot, they either are gonna take you up on it or they're not. Don't badger them, don't send them 16 emails, don't, you know, it's, you're really probably at that point, you're just digging yourself further in where not only maybe are they not going to use you, but they're gonna tell everyone they know, like, though, this, not only did I not like it, but they're terrible. Don't use them, right? You get this like negative word of mouth, which is not what you want.
Yeah, I would call it's definitely a Band-Aid, but, like, you're also bleeding. So, like, Band-Aids aren't necessarily always the worst thing. It doesn't fix the cut, but it makes it not as bad. And if it's easy to install, you should do it.
So let's talk a little about the plan switching idea. That's, I think it's a really good, a really interesting, you know, opportunity to offer them. So in that case, you'd be saying we'd be going for a longer period or a shorter period. What's the advice around, you know, switching them? Maybe if you don't have tiers and you have length or something.
Yeah, I've seen this work kind of in two ways. One is, like, if you have multiple tiers, especially in, like, an enterprise context, like, they might be signed up for 50 seats and, like, they went through downsizing. Now they have 25 people. Instead of losing them completely, like, let them switch down to a cheaper tier. I think in the consumer space, the more common tactic I've seen is, like, you show them a non-public plan. So, like, if you go cancel, like, I did this with Zoom, and it's like you go from whatever Zoom's lowest tier is to a version that's, like, $7 a month that you can only have 5 meetings and the meetings are only 40 minutes and you can't share with other people. And, like, if you're a solo person, that's probably fine. I'd say it's right. More common.
And it's something that you can't buy that, right?
Like, yeah,
you can only get that if they, if they offer it to you, right?
Yeah, I think the risk here is maybe it's just me because I study subscription products all day, but consumers are becoming more aware of this. So like every 3 months, I go through my SaaS tools and see if I can get any discounts on the cancellation flow. Like I'm probably unique in this way, but it's another thing I would pay attention to. And if you see a big chunk of people doing it and your overall churn rate hasn't changed, you might want to set up some controls.
Almost like a modern version of couponing where like there's pretty people much, that are yeah. really, really into that, right? And if they just detect that this is a pattern they can exploit for their own benefit, they might try it. That's a good thing to keep a lookout for. So let's talk a little bit about what are the concrete benefits of trying to keep someone around through switching them? I mean, other than just not losing them as a customer, have there been, I guess, long-term benefits to having them switch to a lower tier, a different length, a slightly different price that maybe is not public? You know, what other than maybe, like you said, in your case, they got another year of clear out of you. Does that eventually lead to a place where maybe you decide next time, oh, I don't want to cancel clear because it turns out I actually am now receiving long-term value versus they've gotten one extra renewal out of you and then that's kind of it.
You mean, I think in the subscription game, you're always trying to increase LTV. And obviously you want to do it in ways that are like ethical and good for the user. I think the plan switching at the end or in the middle is one end. Another tactic that can be harder to implement, but is like does pay off is finding like high happiness moments in the product and trying to push them to longer plans. So like, oh, you just had your 20th workout in the row. Do you want to save 50% this year by switching to an annual plan? It's one of those like doesn't change the business dramatically, but you collect more money up front. It lowers the payment processing churn and the users like do commit to it. I think one of the biggest tactics that we saw work at Code Academy was how you price the monthly and annual plans at the beginning of the purchase cycle. So I'd say consumer products kind of fit into one of two buckets. It's like a habit that goes on for more than a year. So rent, insurance, certain like gyms, lifecycle products, utilities, that kind of thing. You tend not to see those companies give annual plans because companies are going to be on these for a long time. Like your cell phone probably doesn't have an annual plan because you're going to be a Verizon or Google or whatever customer for 15 years probably until you switch. So the other bucket is like the shorter lifecycle use cases. So like working out, diets, dating, learning, ed tech, where my guess is like most of retention cycles for those products are under a year. So one of the things we kind of stumbled into Code Academy is like, let's say, I don't know, however many years ago, like our average user retention was like 3 or 4 months. We started pricing our annual plan at like 1 or 2 months after that. So you get to show the consumer a bigger discount and it switches like materially more people from monthly plans to annual plans, which goes a long way to boosting your LTV. You boost your LTV because a certain amount of those annual plans will renew next year. So you go from like maybe on average, the monthly people would stay around for 3, 4, 5 months to now like a chunk of the annual plan people stay around for on average 15 months. So it's like you've 3x'd your LTV in that portion. Also makes payment processing much easier. You collect cash up front if you want to use it in acquisition. It's one of those few in subscription, like the rising tide lifts all boats or whatever that phrase is. It's like the percentage of annual plans for most consumer products is the equivalent of average order value for e-commerce, where it's like it makes everything better. Like you want as many people in those as possible. I think one of the interesting things we saw is like once you see this tactic, you can look at other companies who are sit in a space like this, who sit in the sub 1 year retention patterns and back out kind of what their average monthly retention is. So if you look at like the meditation apps, like kind of like Headspace or Calm, they're priced pretty similarly where their monthly plan is almost $13 and their annual plan is like $70, which is a ratio of like just over 5. So it means in the monthly plan, they probably retain people for like 4 months, which kind of makes sense. It's like, you don't really need an app to meditate. Like you either will like meditation or you're not. And if you like it, you will learn you probably don't have to pay to do it because you can literally do it sitting alone in a room with like nothing around you.
That's a really interesting way to kind of like back yourself into an idea of, like you said, you can guess at what their retention is. And it's interesting to think about it too, from the perspective of like a builder or a developer or, you know, a business owner versus a consumer. You look at an annual plan that maybe it says you save 50% over what you would pay if you were paying monthly. And as a consumer, you say, well, potentially, that's a really good deal, right? This, how are we doing this? This annual plan is so much cheaper than the monthly plan. This looks, why would I not do this? It seems great. But from the business side, it's also a positive because you're like, yeah, you're probably only going to stick around for 4 months 5 months. So I'm going to get another month or two's worth of revenue out of you by you paying for this than I would have otherwise gotten. I wouldn't have gotten the year, if I had charged you the full price annual plan, I wouldn't have gotten that anyway. So I'm increasing my value, right, on the business side. And then to the consumer, the user, it also looks like a great deal. It's probably somewhat of a rare time when maybe like both those sides are kind of, the incentives are aligned, right?
It's one of those like great ROI tactics where like, if you're doing this, especially if you're doing this outside of a pricing test, it's a really simple change. It's like modify the payment data within Stripe or the App Store, some cosmetic changes on the page. And I'd say the tips I would have in doing this is like a couple subtleties make this work better. So I would present whatever the plan you want, which is probably the annual plan, on like the left side of your page because your eye reads left to right. And I would quote it in the monthly ratio and also call out the savings, typically in dollars. So instead of saying like the annual plan is like $70, I'd quote whatever that is a month of, you know, six, seven something. And it'll also call out like in dollars, you're saving $50 or whatever that is.
Yeah. So even better than like percent, you're saying, like, as far as I've seen definitely lots of cases where it's say 30%. And your advice actually is even call that out in dollars, like say literally the amount of money that you're saving, which that does make sense. People don't think typically in percents, they think in dollars, right? In raw dollars.
Yeah. I think the rule of thumb I've always heard is like percent under $100, dollars over $100. But I've seen exceptions to that in A/B tests. And I think this is one of those scenarios where just like being really, really clear with the consumer on what happens, like makes a ton of sense. I'd say that there are some limitations to this tactic. So I think this type of consumer psychology works when dollar or value money amount you're paying is like below a threshold they care about. So if your monthly plans are $500 and your annual plans are $5,000, making your annual plans $2,500, I still think is a big decision for consumers. And I haven't seen this be that effective then. But when it's within kind of like the impulse purchase range, I do think it matters.
So let's kind of close out by talking a little bit about tracking the people, right? The users that make up your user base, right? Like how do we know who to focus on, right? I mean, there's everyone from they churn in the first 5 minutes to they stick around forever and everything in between. So how do you make sense of your users and who are the ones that you want to stay? Maybe that are the litmus tests, right, for the larger population.
Yeah, I'd say one of the things I wish we had done earlier at Code Academy is like focus on better tracking the personas. So personas are kind of like a product / design abstraction of like, if you were to categorize the people you have, who would they be? So if you were like Duolingo, it would be people learning languages for fun, like people preparing for travel in some sort, like people trying to reconnect with families. And like the problem you solve will be a different level of value to each of those personas, depending on how important that problem is. So like if I'm getting transferred to Japan for work, like me learning Japanese is way, way more important than like, I'm just kind of going there recreationally for a week. So I think I would set up your best understanding of these in an onboarding survey as early as you can, because you want to be able to tie it to like churn and product behavior later. So what you'll likely see is like your product does better in one of those scenarios for one of those users. And that can affect how you want to market or track people or write blogs or price and sell and upgrade. So I think when we were at Code Academy, we kind of had four main personas, which was what I would call like the hobbyist, like someone who's learning to code like for no real reason. Like this was me. I just liked it. Didn't have anything really to do with my job. I just thought it was interesting. Then you had kind of students who were doing this as a part of a class. Then you had what we'd call like career upskillers. So like an analyst who wants to go from Excel to Python and SQL. And then you'd have what I would call like aspiring engineers. Like we learned in time through tracking that like the first two, the hobbyists and the students, were not really solving that big of a problem and or they don't have that much money. And really like the upskiller was the best solution for Code Academy because Code Academy isn't deep enough to like train engineers kind of soup to nuts. So that then starts to influence like once you see that in the churn, that starts to influence content strategy. Of like, oh, like this is our wheelhouse. Like if we're going to spend money acquiring people, you want to acquire the best possible users. Stay around for the longest.
Lessons that are similar to like your UA strategy, right? Like we talked about like what UA strategies you take, right? Maybe you try a few and then you find one that really is hitting and you focus on that in the same way here, right? You might have, like you said, a few different populations of people that are going to be trying your app out, but there's probably going to be one or two that really hit, you know, the use case and the value you're creating really hits home with them. And then those are the folks that you want to know. And if you don't know that, or if you don't track it, right, how can you find that out? Right? How can you learn that lesson if you're not tracking?
Yeah, this is really hard to backfill. Like once you know your 2 years in, you'll basically never get persona information from the existing users. Like if you email them, 3% will answer it. If you do it in a pop-up survey, 5 to 10% will answer it. But it's like the earlier you do this, even if it's imperfect, the better.
This was a lot. I know that I definitely learned a ton about all of these things. So thank you, Dan, for joining us on the show and sharing all of your experience and knowledge. I think this will be very valuable for our audience. And if you are out there and you are a small dev team, I would say do all of these things. These all seem like really actionable and useful things that are becoming easier and easier to accomplish as well as a small team, definitely. Right? With all the tooling that's available. So it definitely will pay you, you know, large dividends if you invest in some of this stuff.
Yeah, definitely. No, appreciate the invite to come on. I feel like, you know, we spent Code Academy and other companies like 10 plus years learning all these lessons the hard way. You know, if we can pass them on, you know, more than happy to.
It's a great distillation of all of that. I'm sure very hard won. Those were hard won lessons, I'm sure.
Yes, and we appreciate a lot of failures to find these things that work.
All right. Well, thank you very much for coming on. And to the audience, we'll see you next time.
Yeah. Thanks, Ben.